listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Friday. Anything goes Friday here in this first week of post-summerness. We are going to have a conversation or debate or whatever you want to call it with a fellow from the Manhattan Institute about Obamacare at the top of the next hour. But other than that, pretty much whatever you want to talk about. I have a question, and I'm guessing that Syria is going to play large in this. I've been today I was interviewed by Politico. I was a guest on a news network, a radio news network. It's like everybody wants to talk about Syria. I get that, and that's fine. And I'll say it again. When I wrote this book, The Crash of 2016, which is going to be coming out in a month or so, and just became available for pre-order, I essentially warned. Not essentially, I came right out and warned that economic disasters lead to wars, and be very, very careful. You go back and you look at the history of Syria. And what really started the situation in Syria is climate change, global climate change. I've got another new book out. This is a short ebook that just became available. It's over, you can get it at Kindle on Amazon. It's 99 cents. We basically wanted to give it away, but you've got to assign a price to it. Called The Last Hours of Humanity, and it's about global climate change. And that's what happened in Syria. In 2006, a drought began as climate change is moving basically the Sahara Desert or the middle, the desert that runs across the middle part of northern Africa and the Middle East. And as this desert moved into areas of Syria where they had been producing food, you saw in 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, you saw food production fall by up to 80%. Over a million farmers, and these were farmers who had been quite prosperous. They had farms that had been in the families for generations, and they had been principally producing wheat, but they were producing barley and millet and other grains. These farmers were wiped out. I mean, their farms were turned into dust, into desert. And they came into the city, into Damascus and home and some of the other large cities. There's not that many large cities in Syria, principally Damascus. They came into the cities looking for work, and what they discovered was that there was already a 500,000 Palestinian refugees there. There were refugees there from the Iraq War. There's somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million Iraq refugees living in Syria. And then you got the Syrians themselves, people who'd been living in the city forever. And so these farmers who had been pretty high on the food chain and fairly affluent and prosperous and owned land that had value, suddenly their land had no value, they had no money, they had no food, and they're living in the city cleaning toilets for a living or trying to and finding themselves in competition for those toilet cleaning type of jobs, finding themselves in competition for those kinds of jobs with Palestinian refugees and Iraqi refugees. It was a disaster. And then as the price of wheat spiraled up in 2000, as I recall, it was 2007. I don't have this timeline right in front of me here. I'm running this off from memory, so I may be a year off here or there. Apologies in advance. But remember that spike in wheat prices when it later Matt Taibbi did a great takedown piece on Goldman Sachs. It turned out that Goldman Sachs and a bunch of banksters in Wall Street had been gaming the commodities market, and they jacked up the price of wheat for a few months, and it produced wheat riots around the world. Thousands of people, tens of thousands of people died, hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people were involved in these food riots from Bangladesh to Syria. And the Assad government had this huge stockpile of wheat. And they made this terrible mistake, and I think this was 2007, they made this terrible mistake of when the price of wheat went way, way up, they sold their supplies, their strategic stockpiles, thinking that this global climate change stuff was just, you know, it's just a year or two of bad weather. The drought has not gone away yet. In fact, it's getting worse. And when they sold the wheat, the next year, they didn't have any wheat. They couldn't feed their own people. And that's when you saw people starting, this was the Arab Springtime, right? I mean, this is when you saw people starting to protest. Actually, it kind of preceded the Arab Spring in some ways. This was 2008. This is people were out in the streets protesting the lack of food and the lack of food subsidies. The Assad government could no longer, you know, provide food to them. So global climate change drove a crisis, what became an economic crisis, that became a war. Because when the people started protesting, the Assad government, their response to the protests was sort of like, well, I was going to say it was sort of like, you know, the University of California at Davis against the Occupy movement. Remember where the guy just pepper sprayed that whole group of people who were just sitting there, pepper sprayed them in the face? But the Assad government was far worse. They went out and they just, people in the streets protesting the lack of food, they just shot them. Which then produced a response. People were really upset. And boom, next thing you know, you got a civil war going. And it all began with ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers. And it all began with the oil companies dumping carbon into the atmosphere, producing climate change, producing drought. And then it got exacerbated by Goldman Sachs making billions of dollars by manipulating wheat futures. It's amazing how all this stuff kind of fits together, you know? So, you know, for those of you curious about my warnings on this and my also our new book, The Last Hours of Humanity, is all about how global climate change could lead to extinction. You've heard me talk about it here before. And in the next week or so, we're going to have a little video out about it as well. I'll announce it when it comes out. And the book, The Crash of 2016, is about how these kinds of things, I mean, we had the Dust Bowl in the United States back in the 30s that was accompanying the economic crisis. And, you know, to some extent, the economic crisis was brought about by the Roaring 20s, and the Roaring 20s, in part, were fed by unsustainable land practices, farming practices, you know, the plow. This was, I mean, we were just 30 years into gasoline-powered tractors at that point. So we started plowing land in ways that had never been done before, and it turned that land into dust. And it just, you know, this is why FDR created the CCC and started planting trees, you know, trying to restabilize the land in the 30s. So, you know, it wasn't global warming. It was bad agricultural practices, but the consequence was the same. You know, there were food shortages and there was land crises, and this, you know, produced its own set of problems. So anyhow, you look at cereal, you look at this, you look at all these various things and see how all these things fit together, and it's like, whoa, this is fascinating. And then we think we're going to solve this problem, a global warming-caused problem in Syria. We're going to solve it by dropping some bombs. Really? I got to tell you, these generals who are hanging out at the White House, it's not what they're smoking, it's that they're not smoking something. Right? We need to decriminalize pot and get something, you know. Enough said on that, I guess. John McCain seems to agree with me on that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Did you see that? He was just kind of musing earlier today, and he said, yeah, well, maybe we should decriminalize marijuana. Huh? Yeah. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A couple of years back, I, for several months, repeatedly debated a woman who used to be the Texas Railroad Commissioner. I'm forgetting her name now. It's been quite some time, but she was a conservative Republican, and a very worthy debating foe or partner or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, we would go around and around about various issues. But the Texas Railroad Commissioner's office is actually a very powerful office because the, although it sounds like, you know, hey, they're just in charge of railroads, it was put into place back in the day, right, back in the Gilded Age, and the Texas Railroad Commissioner is also responsible for all the oil and gas stuff that goes on in the state of Texas, which, of course, is the economy of Texas. And so they handle a lot of money, and they have a lot of power, that person. And the guy who is the current Texas Railroad Commissioner, Barry Smitherman, is running to be the Attorney General right now, and people take seriously the Texas Railroad Commissioner. And he suggested in an interview with WorldNet Daily, which is the kind of right-wing crazy central, he suggested, and they're still, WorldNet Daily is still promoting birtherism, for example. But anyhow, he in an interview with them, he said that Texas should secede and become an independent nation. So, it being Anything Goes Friday, I'd just like to drop this in, and then I'm going to take your calls here in just a second. This is my question for you. And if you have an idea or thought or suggestion, I'd like to create a little list here. What do you think life would be like in Texas if they seceded from the United States and became their own country? This is a serious question. Would they criminalize homosexuality? Would they bring back stoning of people? I mean, like killing people with stones who have committed anti-biblical crimes? Would they outlaw divorce? Would they outlaw birth control? How would they handle things like poverty? How would they handle unemployment? Would they do away with unemployment insurance? How would they deal with crime? Would they decriminalize pot or would they double down? What would Texas be like if it was an independent country? Would it end up being basically a narco state or only an oil-o state, you know, with a few Texas oil billionaires running the whole thing? Would it become like an old feudal system, a kingdom sort of country? Serious question. If you were going to, you know, write a history of Texas 40 years from now, if you could get in a time machine, go 40 years out, and Texas seceded from the Union this year successfully and became Rick Perry Stan, what would, or Alamo Stan or something like that, what would you be writing? What would you be saying? This is what happened to Texas. So that's my question to you, and I would love to hear your thoughts on that. But it being Anything Goes Friday, anything you want to talk about is fine with me. Mark in Northbrook, Illinois. Hey, Mark.
How you doing, Tom? I've got a thought on our Syria conversation.
Mm-hmm.
A little different. And I've been on the side of not going to Syria with all of the unintended consequences and reasons that have been mentioned from everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's likely now that Congress will not approve the president's plan, and I applaud his bringing the issue to the people. But when Congress says no, I might suggest that the president position this with Syria and the world, saying that the U.S. military stays on alert with the Navy assets remaining in the Persian Gulf and Mediterranean, ready to strike on a moment's notice, monitoring Assad's movements and chemical weapon assets and delivery systems and aircraft,
right,
and closely cooperating with the moderate opposition. Another chemical weapons deployment elicits an immediate unilateral response that will cripple the means of chemical weapons delivery, command and control, and hopefully put the moderate opposition in a position to turn things around.
Did you see an article a couple of weeks back in the New York Times that was headlined words to the effect of "This is no slam dunk"?
I did not, believe me, I'm looking at unintended consequences.
Yeah, no, this isn't about unintended consequences. This is about what the heck's actually going on, and how we don't know. when the UN did send inspectors in to look around into the area where these gas canisters were opened and, you know, where people died, one of the things that they found was homemade rockets. They did not find any evidence of the sophisticated professional rocketry that the Assad government has. They found homemade rockets. This was also a region where the Assad government had enough control over the region that they could actually guarantee, at least for a day, the safety of the UN inspectors. Also, the day, 24 hours after Ban Ki-moon asked the Syrian government for permission to come in and look, the Syrian government granted that permission. And they got him in there. It was only 4 days. It took 4 days, but that's pretty fast for that kind of thing. And what they found was these homemade rockets and the evidence of the gas. There is no clear evidence that I have seen, and I have read all of these reports. I mean, I haven't seen the classified ones, but I've talked with politicians who have seen the classified ones, and they're saying the same thing. There is no clear evidence that this sarin gas was actually released by the Assad government. In fact, the Assad government had a lot to lose by it being released. The rebels, who at that point in time were kind of losing the war, had a lot to gain by this being released. And this was released in an area where the rebels had some power, but the government still had control over it. If the Assad government wanted to use poison gas to kill people to win the war, they would have taken an area that was completely rebel-controlled and killed the people there. They didn't do that. And so this, increasingly, every day that goes by, the more I read about this, the more I think that this was essentially a false flag operation by one of these 1,200 rebel groups.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Which, Mark, makes it very, very hard to say, okay, you do this one more time and we're going to hit you. How do you know it's even been done once? And when this next time, how do you know that? Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And what would Texas be like if it was its own nation? I wonder about that. John seems to think it would be pretty good. John and Azel, is it Azel, Texas, or Azel?
Azel.
Azel, Texas. So, your thoughts on...
Azel without the H.
So, okay.
I got to agree with you on the Syria thing, you know, then I'll get to the Texas thing.
Sure.
A week and a half ago, when the president first came out, and I am a conservative, and I don't care for what this man's done, and please, it's not because of the color of his skin, but when he came out and he said, I've got high confidence that this has happened, that this man launched chemical weapons, drop lead on him. Move those ships in there and make it a piece of glass. Thank God that because he cannot make a decision, that we've got some time here, and now we're starting to see, you know, all the different ramifications. You know, the Russians' largest military installation outside of Russia is a naval base in Syria.
Right. It's their only Mediterranean port, in fact, which is one of the reasons I think why they're a little protective of it.
And then we find out, you know, wow, how gracious and generous that Qatar and Saudi Arabia want to foot the bill for our air support, and come to find out they've been wanting to put a gas pipeline through Syria going to Turkey. So
yep.
A little too much stuff happening here. I think we need to take a couple steps back. And what you were saying, I caught part of it about finding those homemade rockets.
Right.
Starts to make me wonder, you know, about 20 years ago, remember Earth First in Northern California, that some pipe bombs went off in a car and some of the head people of that terrorist organization, they said, oh, we were trying to be assassinated. Come to find out, it was their pipe bombs and they had an accident. Could it be that what you maybe, you know, dovetailing what you said, the rebels had an accident with their gas?
Or could it be that they sent it off intentionally, hoping that the United States would come in and cripple the Assad regime? You know, that this was an intentional thing. And which is, frankly, increasingly what I'm thinking happened. And, it seems far more logical to me. I mean, if Assad was going to use poison gas as a weapon of war, I don't think this is how he would use it. It doesn't make any sense. But, you know, keep in mind, the Free Syrian Army, you know, the major part of the rebel army is made up of people who defected from the Syrian, who were members of the Syrian military. Now, when they defected, they took all kinds of stuff with them, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if they took a couple tons of poison gas with them.
So. And those canisters of poison gas more than likely say property of Saddam Hussein, because that's probably where it all came from.
And actually, it turns out in the paper day before yesterday, it said that Great Britain sold it to him.
Wonderful.
Don Rumsfeld sold it to Saddam Hussein back in the day, back, you know, during the Reagan administration.
I knew I could count on you. It's Bush's fault.
No, it was Reagan's fault.
Okay, yeah, of course.
So Texas.
I was born and raised in California, in the Bay Area, moved to Sacramento, loved the state when it was, you know, you basically had George Dukmejian back-to-back terms, followed by Pete Wilson back-to-back terms, because I'm 53, so you're going to go with what you know. Mm-hmm. And then you had the wacky left-wing legislature there, and they always met in the middle, and the state prospered and did fantastic. And the minute that Gray Davis got in there, and, you know, $15 billion that was in the bank kind of disappeared within less than a year, and no one really knows what happened to it, the state just went downhill. So we up and, you know, at age 45, loaded everything up, sold my business there and came to Texas. And to get to your question, if Texas seceded January 1st, 2014, it would be the same as it is right now. It's kind of the Wild West. I mean, if you want to hang your shingle out here, you can.
Right.
You can just get out here. It's here for the taking. And, you know, just recently there was a poll, and many, many Americans say that, oh, the American dream of achieving and doing, getting those goals is gone. Well, I bet if you broke that down, how many of the negative thoughts come from states like New York, Illinois, California, where the government has just taken over and just squashed every, you know, chance of positiveness, and they've taken.
So how did the government take over in ways that prevented you from doing business, and how is it that in Texas you now can do business because the government is not taking over? What was it?
Let's see. Okay, my property taxes are a little lower here.
Right.
The sales tax is lower. Okay, if you want to start a business.
But that's neither of those things are going to make or break a business. So if you've got a decent idea.
All right, I was a licensed contractor in the state of California.
Uh-huh.
They had less and less every year. So what do we do to get more money? Well, we're going to go ahead and charge more.
Right.
The people who decided to stay legitimate, okay? Right. instead of trying
to get more people
underground and bring them in.
Were you building houses?
I work in swimming pools, and out there, okay, it's so difficult. We build swimming pools out here, remodels, renovations. Do you know how many counties? I live in a county, Tarrant County, and when you live in the true county, I don't need a building permit. I don't have to go down and get permission to be able to add something to my home. You can just do it.
Right.
You can just commerce just moves.
Right.
Here, you should see the construction projects here, the freeways, the interchanges that are going on. Motorola has just now come to North Fort Worth Alliance, which is an airport. It's the FedEx hub, one of their 7 hubs in the country. And they've come there because Texas said, come on in. We're not going to bend you over, you know, and scrutinize every last little tiny thing. And, you know, Motorola is going to begin building the first.
But if you were living in California and you were living downhill from some guy who's building a pool, you know, 400 feet above you and a quarter mile behind you on an earthquake zone, wouldn't you want there to be some standards for that pool for when that earthquake comes?
Well, see, did you hear about the lady that fell out of the ride here about 3-4 weeks ago at Six Flags? She
No.
fell off one of the roller coasters and died. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, California, when that happened, oh, my God, we've got to get a Blue Ribbon Commission, governor's friends, pay these guys $100,000 a year, and begin regulating this.
Wait a minute. You're making this up.
No, I'm not making this up.
So California actually created a Blue Ribbon Commission in response to somebody dying in a roller coaster?
Yes. Yes. Now here.
When did that happen?
That was just before we moved, within the last 10 years.
Okay.
We have to create a regulatory body, okay, to oversee the amusement parks. Do you think the amusement parks?
You would think that they already had one.
Well, they may have already had one, but they created more on top of more.
But you haven't answered my question yet. I can understand in, you know, flat, stable Texas saying, you know, somebody wants to put a swimming pool in, that's fine with us. But it also seems to make sense to me that in a state where, you know, a swimming pool, as you know, is tons and tons of water, and, you know, not to mention concrete and electronics and pipe and whatnot. You got hills and you got earthquakes, that having a swimming pool could be a real disaster for people around them if it was not built well. And whereas in flat Texas, that would be a very different thing, would it not?
All right. Well, no, let me tell you about the North Texas soil here. The soil is very interesting. You need to have a soaker hose around the foundation in your home that kicks on every day for a few minutes, especially when we're in a drought, because the ground here will move. It will move homes. It'll shift the swimming pool. It's bad for business if you don't build a swimming pool properly. Here, when you just don't excavate for the pool, you need to drill for piers to keep the thing from moving. And there are areas here you don't build in because you know the pool's going to move no matter what you do, and we just don't do it. But it's, again, it goes back to, it's bad for my business for me to build a half-assed pool and leave it unsafe.
Right.
I get sued out of oblivion. I don't need the government to come in and tell me you can do this and you can do that and you can't do this.
Well, if you're getting sued, the government's involved in that process. Somebody has to go to a government court to sue you. And there has to be a government law that provides the basis for the lawsuit.
No, here you build a.
So what you're saying is that the form of regulation that's acceptable to you is one that's based on government courts and government laws rather than on government regulatory agencies.
Yeah. I get it. It's my risk, okay? And if I'm an idiot and somebody sues me out of business, well, that's my problem.
Yeah. But there's something to be said for that, and particularly if it's the swimming pool business. But what if you were selling some kind of herbal medication and you came into town and really what you were selling was poison or had, you know, say small amounts of arsenic in it, not enough to kill somebody right away, but enough to give them cancer over a year or two. And you come into some small town and you sell a bunch of the stuff and, you know, some people get sick. And so you say, oh, okay, you move on, right? You go on to the next town. I mean, isn't there, with a swimming pool and a stable business, I get it, that your reputation, that's a fairly, you know, good libertarian argument, right? Where your reputation is going to be the deciding factor for your business. But a lot of businesses are portable. You know, doctors, for example, you know, if they screw up a lot in one particular area, they could just go to another area. Don't you think that there is a role for regulation in our society?
Absolutely. I don't think we're in a full-on capitalistic system. We're in a mixed economy.
Okay.
I agree. You have to have some, but.
But you just think California's gone too far and Texas is doing just fine. So what about the fact that Texas is for every dollar that Texas sends to D.C., they get back about $1.20. That's going to go away.
That's fine.
Yeah. Okay. You're fine with that. John, we're out of time. Thanks a lot for the call. And we will continue. Anything Goes Friday right after this. 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I love libertarians who say, I don't want any government. I want to be able to do it by lawsuit. But lawsuits don't happen in courts. It's the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Jack in Norman, Oklahoma. Hey, Jack, what's up?
I wanted to talk about this Republican suppression effort around the country to suppress the vote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're doing it right now. And the news today out of Iowa is that they're going to take the list of people who the U.S. Department of Immigration or whatever it is, their list of people that they think are illegal in the state. They're going to compare that to the voting rolls. And, of course, you're going to find a lot of Juan Gonzalez's on both rolls, and they're just going to knock everybody off who's got the same name. And, you know, all of a sudden, a lot of people who have Hispanic surnames are going to discover who are American citizens are going to discover they can't vote when they show up at the polls in November.
Yeah, my understanding is that it's a crime under federal law for state officials acting under color of law to conspire to violate the constitutional rights of people. in the, under their jurisdiction.
That is true. But if you look at the decision by the Supreme Court in 2000 in a case called Bush v. Gore, you will discover an affirmative statement by Justice Rehnquist in the majority decision in which he said there is no affirmative right to vote in the Constitution.
Well, clearly there's, I think, what the 15th, one of the civil, one of the 13th, 14th, or 15th Amendment gives the blacks the right.
That's right. The 15th Amendment grants former slaves the right and says you cannot deny people the right to vote based on color, on race, or condition of prior servitude. And the 19th Amendment to the Constitution says that you cannot prevent women from voting. But there is nothing that says that you can't prevent Hispanics from voting or white people from voting or students from voting or old people from voting or Democrats from voting.
Well, certainly some of the people's votes who are being suppressed are women.
Yes.
And some of the, and in fact, it looks like the conspiracy involves a lot of efforts to deny black people the right to vote.
Yes, and that's why the challenges to these Republican voting suppression efforts are almost always based on their impact on minority neighborhoods. Because there is that law, because there is that constitutional amendment, and there is, and there are also the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and 6 or 4 and 5.
Has the Attorney General ever attempted to prosecute a state official for conspiring to deny somebody the right to vote?
This one has not, and I don't know of any previous cases where that has happened. So you're saying that the individual state official should be held liable?
I think if somebody like Rick Perry went to prison for 10 years, all this stuff about suppressing the vote would disappear in a New York second.
Yeah, I think you're right. Jack, thanks for the call. Ron in Long Island, New York. Hey, Ron, thanks for listening to WWRL. What's up?
How are you?
Good.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Yes, how you doing? I was just wondering if Obama bombed Syria, if you're going to have an anti-war protest.
If there was one, I would be there.
You would protest against him?
Yes.
Would you call him a war criminal?
Yes.
You would?
Yes.
And you would go for impeachment?
Perhaps. It would depend on how the bill of impeachment was drawn. But I think that, frankly, I think that you can make a strong argument that President Obama already is a war criminal because of the way he's using drones in countries, killing people in countries that we do not have a declaration of war against and Congress has not authorized actions in. So, and I've realized that kind of language makes me very unpopular at the White House. They don't invite me to their functions anymore. But, hey, it's what I think is true.
And you'll put this call on the air?
You are on the air. We are live right now. 3.5 million people listening as we speak. I've said this before, Ron. This is nothing new. I think that the big crime here, it's not so much Obama's crime. It's that every president, with the exception of Jimmy Carter, since Jack Kennedy, arguably, has engaged in war crimes. Every president of the United States. And Jimmy Carter's the only president who didn't have his own little war. And I think that is the huge crime. It's that we are not holding our presidents accountable. We are not, the mechanism for holding them accountable of impeachment was only used against Bill Clinton, and it was only used because he got, a BJ under the desk or something, however that worked out, because he had sex with Monica Lewinsky, which is the stupidest of reasons to, and he lied about it, stupidest of reasons to prosecute somebody, to impeach somebody. You want to impeach him, you should have impeached him because, he went into Kosovo when the House of Representatives did not grant him the authority to do so. They held a vote, and they voted no.
I'm shocked at your answer, but I'm glad that you feel that way because you're a stand-up guy. If you're going to, like I said, I'm not listening to the radio now. So if you would put, if you do put this on the air, then you really do believe in what you say.
Yeah, I really do. We really are, and yeah.
But at least answer me this one question. How come you're not ranting and raving the way that the liberals and the progressives ranted against Bush every day. Every day that you are screaming at about this guy, which maybe you have a legitimate scream, but it just doesn't seem like the
Well, I didn't scream about Bush every day either. I mean, you know, if you ask me the question, is George Bush a war criminal, I'd say yes, and I've said that many times,
but,
too.
But you can honestly say that you aren't pushing the issue that he should be tried in The Hague, and he's a war criminal,
yeah.
And Bush lied,
yeah.
And people died. That wasn't a subject
oh, sure.
of your program every day.
Yeah, no, I said that frequently. I think that the order of magnitude of Bush's war crimes relative to Obama's war crimes is like 1,000 to 1. I think Obama has done things that are unconstitutional and illegal, both by U.S. law and international law. But I think that George Bush, in lying us into a war in a huge way, and having stated even before he was elected president back in 1999 that he fully intended to do so, I think that that is a crime that is a magnitude, an order of magnitude, several orders of magnitude greater. So I do differentiate between the two. Thank you, Ron, for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Ren and Dana and Bernard and Burl and Matt and Charles and Sanchez and Royce and Peter and Tom in Seattle, Bowie, West in Washington, Texas, Wisconsin, Arizona, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, California, Florida, Minnesota, and New Jersey. Hang on the line. We will get to you. It is Anything Goes Friday, but first I wanted to have a conversation here with Ovik Roy, who is a senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute, editor and principal author of The Apothecary, the Forbes Health Care blog. The website is manhattan-institute.org, and Ovik has recently put out an article that basically says Obamacare is going to jack up your rates. Do I have that right?
Well, it depends on where. It's not, you can't generalize with this law. Everyone's affected in a slightly different way.
Okay. I read your article. I looked through the math. We tried, two of us tried to actually, mostly it was Danielle did it, tried to replicate your math, and we can't do it. We can't make your numbers work. First of all, you seem to ignore the fact that anybody who makes less than 400% of poverty, which is 80 grand a year, is going to get some kind of government subsidies. You're talking about premiums.
That's not exactly right. So we don't ignore the fact that some people get subsidies, but this is a work in progress. So the first set of data that we've put out is the impact of the law on gross premiums. So that's gross premiums without the effect of subsidies.
Right.
And the third data set, so if you go to the map, there's a section that says your decision, which is not completed yet.
Right.
What that section will do is it will explain the impact of subsidies on you. And remember that, yes, different people at different income levels will get subsidies, and it's not $80,000 for everyone. It's $80,000 for a household of four. So if you're
right.
single and childless, the threshold for getting subsidies is actually more like $40,000.
Right.
It's complicated again. It depends on how large your household is.
No, but by doing that, by ignoring that,
the cost of the premiums in your state, all those factors play a role in what happens, and then the subsidies play a role. So the thing is, it's not merely that you're eligible for subsidies that makes a difference. Actually, the amount of the subsidy matters. So if your premiums,
but you're not including those in the numbers. You're coming out and you're saying to people, look at this Obamacare. The premiums are going to go up. Well, maybe in some states the premiums do go up, but the amount that you're going to pay out of your pocket is going to go down unless you happen to be above the median income in the United States. Is so certainly above, you know, $80,000 is pretty good for a family of four. And you fail to mention that. I think this presentation, demonstrates the old cliche from Abraham Lincoln, that figures don't lie, but liars can figure. Well, respectfully.
You clearly didn't read the piece carefully, because we do discuss the impact of subsidies and explain quite clearly that the subsidies will have an impact for some people, not for everyone, and that there's another economic point, which is that if you drive up the underlying cost of insurance, the subsidies only protect some people, not everyone. And so driving up the underlying cost,
right, they're not going to protect the Koch
brothers. Is a very important. The subsidies aren't free, right? The subsidies are paid by taxpayers. So you have to take that into account. It's not necessarily a good thing that you drive up the cost of
insurance. No, I know. The taxes, you know, there's a 3% tax increase on everybody who makes more than, what is it, $150,000 a year?
That's not the only tax in the law. There's a quite a large battery of taxes, including some taxes that affect people in the middle class.
Yeah, there's a tax on profits of over $250,000 a year.
Plans taxed at a pretty significant rate. So, right. So I mean, you know, this is all.
But you don't point any of those things out.
In the explanatory article that accompanies the map.
I see. So don't just look at the map and don't just read the simple, straightforward stuff that says, oh, my God, Obamacare is going to raise your premiums. Dig deep into the numbers and the footnotes, and you'll discover that you might actually spend less out of pocket.
Well, it says quite clearly at the top, it's for more on our findings, see the accompanying article. There's links to our methodology. There's explanatory descriptions everywhere of what happens. But your point about the subsidies is a key point, which is to say, who will benefit from the subsidies and how many people will benefit from subsidies? This is a point of energetic debate among credentialed, credible, thoughtful people. But it's incorrect to sort of dismiss increases in premiums by saying, well, everyone's going to benefit from subsidies, so it doesn't matter. That's not true. Some people at the real bottom end of the spectrum will benefit from subsidies, but a lot of people...
Well, you also, in your methodology states, and I'm quoting... You said, in determining who would be eligible for subsidies, we assumed a complete Medicaid expansion and therefore excluded those below 139% of the federal poverty level. The ACA, parenthesis, the ACA expands Medicaid to 133% with a 5% income disregard, making it effectively up to 138%. End of quote. So basically, by taking out all of that Medicaid expansion from your calculations, you're saying, you know, okay, here's the average, but we're going to ignore all the low end, all the free stuff, and all these people who are going to get, you know, this Obamacare for essentially free, and we can debate the meaning of that word, and I'm guessing you'll want to, but by excluding that, you're throwing all your numbers off.
That's not true at all. So again, we state very clearly that the point of this exercise is to discuss how the Affordable Care Act affects this very specific population.
Right, the upper income brackets.
People who shop for insurance on their own, who have incomes higher than 138% of the federal poverty level. That's exactly the group that we're talking about. And if you didn't read that in the analysis, then you didn't read it carefully.
I just read it to you.
It's quite clearly stated in the analysis.
Right, I just read it to you, and it seems that when you...
So this is not misleading. You know, we're being very upfront. Smart. Read Jonathan Cohn's take on it today. I mean, he and I have gone back and forth on this quite a bit, and he agrees that this is a reasonable and fair analysis. He may be more optimistic about the outcome of what happens on
the
exchange.
He's quite
optimistic
about that.
But in terms of the analysis and the methodology and the facts, there's really no dispute about the facts in this situation.
You also, I found no mention in here of the impact on people of other dimensions of Obamacare. Like, for example, your health insurance company can no longer say, you hit your lifetime premium when you got cancer, or, you know, payout. We're not going to pay for the last half of your treatment. Sorry, go die.
No, again, quite the opposite. So this is not meant to be an encyclopedia of the Affordable Care Act. If you want the encyclopedia, you can download the...
But the Affordable Care Act, at the very least, they break out three plans. You know, you've got bronze and silver and gold or whatever it is. Why didn't you mention those?
Increase the regulatory constraints in the insurance business, and so there will be a lot of things that are different about the product. And the question is, what will be the cost of that? So will people value... So your point is, well, there are going to be all these benefits,
sure,
because the insurance product is going to protect you more, but that's going to cost more. So the question is, do people want to pay
not
more?
Not necessarily. It could be costing the insurance companies more. The insurance companies are limited to only a 20% profit now. They could make a 30, 40, 50% profit before. Now they're limited to a 20% profit.
That's actually incorrect. So insurers don't make a 20% profit. The typical profit margin for a publicly traded for-profit insurer is about 4 to 6%.
Yeah, but the, I'm talking about total overhead. You're right. You're absolutely right. I shouldn't say profit. Let me say, you know, Stephen J. Hemsley, who has made over $1 billion as the CEO of United Healthcare, and the over 100 executives at United Healthcare who make over $1 million a year, they may have to make, he may only make a couple $100 million instead of $1 billion, and his $1 million executives might become $700,000 a year executives. I realize that's not classically considered profit. But,
not,
you know,
actually correct, actually. So if you look at the stock prices of insurance companies, they've all skyrocketed in the last 3 years since the Affordable Care Act was passed.
Of course,
why?
More people are going to have insurance.
This law is a giveaway to insurance companies. It doesn't restrain private insurers at all.
It's not a giveaway to them. It is expanding the base for their products. It is going to stabilize and strengthen them. It's going to do the things that cause stocks to go up. But it's not necessarily going to be.
At all because you,
it's not necessarily going to be a good
premium
thing for the CEO who wants to take $1 billion. So
watch their salaries over time. You'll see they're going to stay the same or go up.
Okay. Well, if that's the case, then I'm horrified. Ovik Roy, Manhattan-Institute.org is the website. This was published over at NationalReview.com as well. Thanks for being with us today.
Sure thing.
We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And what would life be like in Texas if they seceded and it became Rick Perry Stand? Past the hour, talk media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman Program. Ren in Seattle. Hey, Ren, what's up?
How you doing today? Thanks for taking the call. I just recently read a book called Eagles and Empires that goes through the North American fight for North America between the United States and Mexico.
Hmm.
And after the war, the United States, in part of the negotiations over what was going to happen with all the new territories west of Texas, the United States government then paid off Texas's Republic of National Debt. So if they were to secede, should we not get that money back? And in any divorce, don't we split this everything down the middle 50-50? And since Texas is a net red state as far as the federal treasury, right, don't we then take out all of the federal installations there?
Mm-hmm.
How do they afford to secede?
Right. So we take the military installations back. I wonder what we do about
NASA,
the, you know, 100 years or so of money that we've been giving them.
We just let that go because that's part of being part of the United States. But when we paid off the Republic of Texas' national debt, 160 years of interest must, you know, no matter what it was, would add up to trillions of dollars.
Huh. Now, was that
if we stopped taking any of their oil, what kind of economy does Texas have with no federal money, no military, no NASA, and owing us hundreds of millions or billions and billions of dollars a year in their payments to pay us back for their national debt that we initially paid off?
Right. Sounds pretty grim. It doesn't sound. Does,
nowhere for them to go.
There you go. Okay, Ren, thanks a lot for that. That's by the way, was that during the presidency of Polk?
Yes. It was actually after Polk. It was Taylor.
Taylor.
No,
okay.
Taylor. When that actually happened.
Okay.
Happened a couple of years after the war. But if you want a good read on it, it's called Eagles and Empire. But the name of the author escapes me.
I'll have to check it out. Ren, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Burl in Sierra Vista, Arizona. Hey, Burl.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks. I'm a big fan of your show. I'm a retired educator, so I was thinking that if Texas did secede from the Union,
right,
that maybe that would get them out of the business of writing textbooks for the rest of the country and curriculum. So that would be actually a good thing.
Yeah, we should be encouraging that because Texas is the only state that has a Board of Education that California could and they should, but Texas is the largest purchaser of textbooks, and their Board of Education is run by crazy right-wingers. And so textbooks all across the United States are written to satisfy the Texas standards, and thus, evolution is still a debate and global warming might not be happening.
And I've seen some of the things that they want to take out of social studies textbooks and what they want to include, and it becomes a book that belongs in the fiction section.
Oh, yeah, they wanted to remove the history of the labor movement and replace it with the history of Grover Norquist and Ronald Reagan? I'm not making this up.
No, I know. They want to include Phyllis Schlafly and right. McCarthyism and delete Martin Luther King.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's amazing.
I wanted to ask you one other quick thing, though. You
sure.
mentioned a book of yours, I think it was The Last Hours of Humanity.
Yes, that's the title.
Okay, I looked for that on Kindle and couldn't find it.
If you just type in Last Hours of Humanity into the Amazon search engine, and you can do it at Barnes & Noble, and
okay.
presumably you can do it at Powell's. I haven't tried, you know, Powell's, the independent bookstore. But I've bought my own book from both Barnes & Noble and Amazon just to make sure it worked, because we released the book August 25th. And so if you type in Last Hours of Humanity and my name, it'll pop up. The other way to do it is to go to the Tom Hartman author page over on Amazon. You know, look for any book of mine and then just click my name and it'll take you to the author page. And then you can click on Show Kindle Books. And you got to go to the second page of my books that are on Kindle, because this is a brand new book, and they list them by how many books have been sold, and it's only been in print, in quotes, for a week and a half, and so not very many have been sold. So it's on the
okay.
second page, but it's there on the Kindle page, on the Tom Hartman author page too. So it's not hard to find, and like I said, it's 99 cents, and it's a short book. It's maybe a third the size of a regular book in terms of word count, but. It's all about global.
Well, I'm really looking forward to your Crash of 2016. I have that pre-ordered also. So.
Yeah, that's a masterpiece. That book, you know, Sam Sachs is an editor who worked with me on that, and we put a lot of research and 2 years of work, maybe a little more than 2 years of work into that book. So, and that'll be shipping in October. So, Burl, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for your kind words, and good luck, and get back to me if you can't track that book down. It should be easy to find, though. Matt in Amherst, Massachusetts. Hey, Matt, you wanted to talk about Syria?
Yeah, I actually want to talk about a couple things, too. First of all, the whole Republican-Democrat thing, I don't understand why people argue over all the little issues. What people really need to see is just a big thing. You know, you're basically
Matt, pardon my interrupting you. Are we on speakerphone? Because it's hard to hear you.
Oh, sorry. I'll take you off. I was in a bad spot. I just walked out of the house.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, like, you know, basically, if you haven't noticed, you know, as you mentioned, since basically the, you know, Reagan Nixon era, Republicans and Democrats have pretty much been following the same policy. But beyond that, with Syria, there's a lot of videos that have come out now that, you know, that that the rebels have committed the attacks. There's actually two videos out that announce it.
That the rebels, you know, committed the gas attacks?
Yes. And you can find them on YouTube. I hate to say you can find them on InfoWars, because some people find that site a little bit.
Yeah, it's Alex Jones's site, but that doesn't mean that it's wrong.
Yeah. No, because he obviously, you know, quotes Washington Post and everything. You know, you just got to
sure.
kind of read some things with a... fine eye, but yeah, he's got two videos up posted that they did it. One of them called it an accident, and that they were given, you know, a bunch of like generals gave some unqualified combatants a bunch of chemical gas, and that, you know, the big accident happened with that, and then that got spilled over, killed all them, killed a bunch of other civilians as well.
Huh. Interesting. Okay, Matt, I'll have to check it out. Thanks a lot for the call. So my, my theory is apparently, well, obviously not unique to me. And I should have known Alex Jones would get there first. We'll be right back. 26 minutes past, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's Anything Goes Friday, whatever you want to talk about, from Syria to 9/11. But I'm curious, what would happen if Texas went independent, became the nation of Rick Perry stamp? Welcome back to Viagra for Your Brain, the Tom Hartman Program. Just don't tell Limbaugh he'll want some. You know, it does not cause stiff thinking, however, I promise. Okay, an independent Texas would probably return to slavery. They do away with the minimum wage. There'd be fertilizer plants all over the place. The textbooks would be a little funky, but the rest of us would get to actually learn things. Our school books would be uncontaminated. That's a great start. So We're creating a list. And by the way, in the one of the big news stories today is that the state of Iowa, the Republican Secretary of State in Iowa, wants to start purging the Iowa list of illegal voters, on people who are voting while illegal aliens. And, you know, when they tried this in Florida, and they tried this in, there was one other state they tried it in, and where they take the list of, the federal list of people that are in that state that they know are not legal, that are not legal, and they're in the state. And they take that list, and they match it up to the voter list. And when they did that in Texas, they came up with, I think it was 133 matches. They went, aha, look at this, voter fraud. We got illegal aliens registered to vote. And then they went and knocked on their doors and discovered that, no, it's just two people with the same name, you know. And like, with Anglo-Saxon names, I mean, there's a lot of John Smiths. With Hispanic names, there's a lot of Juan Gonzalez's or whatever. I mean, you know, it's... And so you're going to have a lot of duplication. And when they finally looked at all 133, they discovered there was zero. They did find one illegal voter. I think it was in Texas where they tried the same thing. One. And, but they want to do this in Iowa, knock, 20, 30,000 people off the voting rolls. And then after the election, all those people with Hispanic surnames can. When they'll be given placebo ballots. Hey, I don't see your name on the list here. Here's a provisional ballot, which will not be counted, so they won't probably even know that their vote wasn't counted. I mean, the Republicans have got this thing down. You know, how to get people off the voting rolls. But anyhow, anything goes Friday. Charles, Newcastle, Pennsylvania. Hey, Charles.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to thank you for being a resource for conscientious people everywhere.
Thank you.
And, I wanted to put some cautionary food for thought out with such a serious situation there in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a great fan of conspiracy theories, but after watching the movie Syriana again, I just would like to know if there's anybody in the government or private oversight committees that are looking into the fact that maybe the people responsible for this gas attack may have been funded by a dirty tricks department.
Well, is this a CIA false flag operation kind of thing? Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there has been precedent in that area.
Yeah, there has been, but I would be both horrified and astounded. I think, though, that we are funding, there is one scenario under which that could be possible, and that is that we are funding some of the Syrian rebels, in quotes, and if it turns out that it was Syrian rebels who released the sarin gas and killed these, 1,000, 1,500 people, whatever it is, in order to get us to come in and bomb the bejesus out of Mr. Assad so that the rebels can win the war because they're not doing so well right now, then arguably our tax dollars were behind it. I would not be. I hope that's not the case. I am skeptical that that's the case, but I would not be astounded if that was the case.
Right. I hadn't heard the the question put out there, and I was. Just wanted to get it out there to see if anybody else might.
The simple question that always needs to be asked, the old Occam's razor question, Occam's razor, of course, the doctrine that typically when there's a variety of possibilities, possible answers to a question, the one that's most straightforward is the one that's accurate. But the corollary to that is Occam's question, which is who benefits? And when you answer the question who benefits, you very often figure out, why something was done. And the Assad government, I can see absolutely no benefit to him to killing 1,500 people in parts of the country that he actually has some reasonable amount of control over, enough control that he can offer safety to the UN when they send their inspectors in there. If he was going to use this stuff as a weapon of war to kill the opposition forces, then why wouldn't he drop gas canisters into those towns or communities that are 100% rebel controlled, that are basically, you know, flipping him the bird. I mean, that would make sense to me. Then he might, you know, put the fear of God in them, and you could say that's a, you know, that's a legitimate, maybe not legal, but that's a technique of war. And but gassing people, killing people who are in an area that you still have some control over, and in fact a majority of control over, just, you know, a couple days before the UN says they're coming into town, this makes no sense to me at all. But the people that do benefit from the world being outraged by thinking that Assad gassed his own people, and I'm no fan of Assad. You know, the guy's a thug and a criminal, and, you know, any other adjective you want to attach to it. But the people who do benefit are the rebels, and some of these rebels are Al Qaeda. And Al Qaeda has demonstrated in the past a absolute willingness to kill innocent people to accomplish their political ends. They did it in the United States, in New York City, on September 11, 2001. And they've done it all over the world. And so, you know, gassing a few people for the greater good and to bring about the ultimate, you know, world that they want wouldn't surprise me at all. Charles, thanks for the call. Sanchez in Long Beach, California. How are you?
A very gracious day to you, like I'm having right now, senor.
Thank you.
And very quickly, because I did want to speak about the NSA, but several months ago, you may recall that I was giving you some information regarding the Benghazi attack and the possible involvement of the CIA, and a lot of the facts that I did pass your way came to be true. That was included when Jake Tapper, back on the 1st of August, Jake Tapper from CNN, did that report involving all those CIA agents that were there at the CIA annex in Benghazi.
Yep.
And there's a connection definitely between Libya and Syria. From other websites like Global Research, I've been able to read that there was, even though Jake Tapper's only inferring, that they were sending those weapons, those surface-to-air missiles back to Syria, there is a definite connection between those two countries with the CIA. So, like you say, on Fridays here, anything goes. Anything is possible in that scenario. So I'm not actually canceling that out.
And in my mind, as long as anything is possible, as long as it's possible that it was not the Assad government that committed this gassing, then our compounding that by committing the international crime of an act of war against a country that has not threatened us or hurt us, without the sanction of the United Nations, without the collaboration of the NATO countries,
mm-hmm.
And without the International Criminal Court even having been consulted, and without the Arab League saying, yes, we're part of this, just right. Seems to me like walking on very, very, very thin ice. Just
exactly.
Very thin
exactly.
Ice.
Well, I wanted to bring up something here about the stories that sort of fell between the cracks this week mm-hmm. that do deserve some attention. They both involve the NSA. Earlier this week, in fact, on Monday, it was revealed through Glenn Greenwald's revelations from Edward Snowden that the NSA was spying on both the presidents of Mexico and Brazil. At the time, Enrique Peña Nieto from Mexico was only a candidate, but Dilma Rousseff, the president of Brazil, was definitely in office, and the records show that the NSA was spying on not only her, but her closest top advisors. Senor, I didn't really know that Al-Qaeda spoke Portuguese, did you?
Yeah. We've been spying, apparently, on pretty much everybody. I mean, right. you saw the revelation that the last G20, we were tapping people's yeah. phones. I mean, I think it's probably likely that most of the intelligence agencies of all the major countries of the world do the same thing to the extent
right.
that they can. And if they can't, and if they don't, they want to. But still, it's time for some oversight. It's time for some serious oversight.
The person that I've been following that's been a whistleblower from very, very early on, Russ Tice, as a matter of fact, you were talking about something here, and Russ Tice has been, you know, been a whistleblower, a former NSA analyst since 2005. So a lot of this information, in fact, the information about the NSA deliberately collaborating with software writers in order to provide them with these back doors so they can gain right. access into your computer. It's things like that.
Not just software writers, big software companies.
Correct. Correct. You were mentioning that film, The Lives of Others.
Yes.
Isn't that a great film?
It is. But everybody should watch that movie.
we're very close to that. In a recent episode of Breaking the Set with Abby Martin, they just had Russ Tice back on for an encore interview where he was clarifying a lot of the things that he said in his prior interview, his appearance back in July, I think the 25th or something like that, where he was saying because of the NSA and because of the CIA, there's that possibility of blackmail going on. And I just feel that somehow or another, for them to be wiretapping the president of Brazil the way they are, it would seem to me that they're doing it for more of those.
Yeah, and you say, oh, no, we would never do that. And then you look back and you see where J. Edgar Hoover actually informed Martin Luther King that he had sex tapes of Martin Luther King having sex with his mistress and maybe he should commit suicide. I mean, you know, stuff like this actually happened. It is amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Sanchez, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You know, this is not to indict the United States government. We have an extraordinary government and a wonderful country. It's to say we all need to be more involved. It is 10 minutes before the hour in the second hour of our program, which means that we're going to pick up Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service and find out, and I noticed that we have a caller from France, Marilyn from France, and if it's costing you a lot of money to call, you might want to just call back in about 15 minutes, Marilyn, and we'll pick up your call, because right now it's time for the news. The Talk Radio News Service, Bob Ney, is with us, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hey, Congressman, how are you doing?
Good, Tom. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So what's happening in the world today?
Well, we have a couple of things. There are some actual domestic issues, but, of course, Syria dominates everything. The president's going to take his case to the American people through national television. And I think one of the reasons, if the vote were held today, it's in a little bit of trouble in the House side, at least, although they have lost some Democratic support, such as Manchin, you know, was talked about quite a lot from West Virginia, Senator Manchin, in the Senate. But the president is taking his case out. He is leaving the summit in Russia. There were some pleasantries exchanged in the sense of neither gentleman, Putin or him, went out and went nuts on each other.
Right.
So there was some graciousness there, I guess. But Syria, of course, was the talk of that entire thing. One debate is starting on Capitol Hill, not so much public, but with intelligence information on the resistance, because some mention was made about some good guys there. That's being debated, too, about what the resistance is really about. So a lot of secondary issues are flowing into this whole Syria debate beyond chemical weapon usage.
Well, and there's, as far as I can tell, Bob, there's still a question about whether it was the Assad government, whether it was rogue elements in the Assad government, or whether it was the one of the various rebel groups, perhaps the Free Syrian Army, the group that, you know, actually was part of the Assad government and left and may have taken some poison weapons, poison gas with them, who set this stuff off. I mean, when the UN went in and looked around, they saw homemade rockets. They didn't see the sophisticated rocketry that you would expect if it was an official government operation. I don't understand why the Obama administration is speaking with such certainty on this and yet not willing to lay the evidence on the table for us all to see.
Well, then that's a problem because, look, there are members still out there, and if I were still there, that were burnt by the big lie, the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Right.
And they showed you this and showed you that.
When you say members, you mean members of Congress.
Yes, I was, you know, there, and there's still some members existing that lived through those days, and it makes one have some suspicion if they won't lay it out to the members privately of all details and, you know, or what the members are seeing, is it accurate? And it creates suspicion. So I think that's another element out there. You know, people have been burnt on this in the accuracy.
So are you saying that, to the best of your knowledge as a reporter, that and of course you know members of Congress, you used to be in Congress, that so far that my assertion is accurate, that so far the administration has not presented clear, irrefutable, here is the proof that Bashar al-Assad is responsible, that he pulled the trigger, as it were, on gassing these people?
Oh, I think it's a fact that your assertion is correct, because I think it's a fact that members of Congress are still not, there are certain members, and some will be convinced, that still do not feel that, you know, significant absolute proof is out there. And they're being told about the ricin, you know, that's being tracked, can only be from Assad. But I know there's some doubt and suspicion out there about our intelligence sources. And again, some of the same people are still hanging around there from 10 years ago or
so. Sure. Sure, yeah. I'm waiting for John Bolton to come out of the woodwork. Yeah.
Oh, my Lord. I always told the kids if they misbehave, that's their babysitter.
You are a bad man, Bob.
Oh, he's a horrible, I'm sorry, but he's a horrible human being. Horrible.
Yeah, yeah. He's he used to come out and debate me. He hasn't done that in several years.
Oh, really?
Now. Yeah, yeah.
Love to watch that.
Yeah,
You'd get him.
I have to go back a ways in the archives. But so what else is happening in the world?
Well, I did want to mention this because I think it's a very interesting situation that's not getting much attention, but Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal is really going against the Obama administration. He wants his state schools voucher program to allow children from low-income areas to attend, quote, better schools. And the Justice Department, I think a lot of people don't realize they are in U.S. District Court. They are saying this is discriminatory. This is a very interesting issue to watch because for the first time in some modern history, you know, the feds are actually weighing in on the school voucher issue as a discrimination tool in states. So I think it's a very interesting issue to watch.
So the feds are saying that the Jindal's voucher program is encouraging segregation, essentially, or discriminating against people based on race or economics?
Yes, and based on economics. And so the Obama administration is, you know, saying that in U.S. District Court that they distributed vouchers, that Louisiana distributed vouchers in nearly 600 public schools and districts that are under orders, and the vouchers really do not help desegregation. So it's a race issue, but also you've always got the economic side too. In the poorer areas, the schools are worse.
Right.
Now, Jindal was saying, well, that's a backward argument.
Well, no, that's always been the knock on vouchers is that, you know, if the average cost of school in a state is, say, $7,000 a year, you pass out a voucher for $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 a year. And then, you know, people have the option of going to the free public schools, which have been turned into basically ghettos because everybody who, you know, the more affluent people have all gone with the vouchers. And the vouchers are basically just subsidies to people who have enough money to come up with a couple $1,000 a year to send their kids to private schools. And so if the voucher amount is at the very bottom of that threshold rather than somewhere in the middle where, you know, you can afford to send your kid to a good school, it would be clearly discriminatory.
And then the department has narrowed this. Justice is saying specifically that it's trying to stop the state of Louisiana from distributing school vouchers in any district that remains under a desegregation court order. And so it's specifically narrowed, but of course Jindal is taking it that, you know, the feds are trying to stop the voucher program.
Right.
They're obviously saying if they're under desegregation order, this is not helping, you know, the desegregation issue.
Something
to watch for the future.
Yeah, okay. I'll keep an eye on it. Bob Ney, former Congressman Bob Ney, author of Whiplash?
It is these.
Sideswiped. I gotta set that book right out. It's such a great book, Sideswiped. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Avalanche just doesn't cover it, writes Waters over at Daily Code. Meteor Blades over at Daily Code. Congressman Jason Chaffetz, the Republican, tweeted that he's received 500 emails with one in favor of intervening in Syria. Democratic Representative Alan Lowenthal of California says he's gotten 653 emails, 11 favoring striking Syria. Bernie has a poll going on over at his website, sanders.senate.gov. And if you're on his email list, if you get his newsletter, the Bernie Buzz, which I do, so I got this poll in the mail this morning, in the email this morning. And so I went over and voted. And he's got, like, you know, more than 18,000 people. This was as of 10 o'clock this morning. So there's a lot more now, I'm sure. For example, here are the numbers. He asked the question, would you favor or oppose the U.S. conducting military strikes against Syria in response to reports that the Syrian government used chemical weapons? Favor, 1,555. Opposed, 15,657. Question, do you think U.S. military strikes in Syria? This is Bernie Sanders' questionnaire. You can fill it out over at sanders.senate.gov. Do you think U.S. military strikes in Syria would be likely to lead to a long-term U.S. military commitment there or not? Likely, 13,700. Not likely, 1,800. So it's almost 10 to 1. And then, you know, what are the following three issues do you think are most important for Congress to concentrate on right now? The top three issues were jobs and unemployment, number one, health care, number two, and education, number three. And, 14,000 votes for health care. Chemical weapons in Syria, a little over 1,000 votes, 1,400. So nothing else was even close. Oh, and global warming. Global warming had 8,300 votes. So, I'm sorry, the top three are jobs and unemployment, health care, and global warming. So good on Bernie for doing that. Anyway, that's what's going on. I think it's really interesting. You know, Nancy Pelosi now coming out and saying, you know, this would be a lot easier if the president would make a stronger case. Yeah, I think. I would be probably more supportive of this. I don't think that I would ever be supportive of the United States unilaterally taking military action against any other country anywhere in the world when our interests are not at stake and we have not been attacked. So I guess I'm a serious old-fashioned isolationist. But that said, if at least there was some clear evidence that Bashar al-Assad is actually killing his own people with poison gas. I mean, there's clear evidence he's killing his own people. But that's a civil war. I mean, shouldn't it be the policy of the United States that we don't intervene in civil wars? We don't take sides in civil wars. And in terms of poison gas, I mean, you know, during the Reagan administration, Ronald Reagan knew that Saddam Hussein was using poison gas to kill Iranians up on the Iranian border. In fact, his administration provided Hussein with intelligence, with satellite photos showing where the people were so they could drop poison gas on him. And Reagan didn't, I realize that, you know, the gentle congresswoman from Florida yesterday came out and said, well, Reagan would have put a stop to this. No, he didn't. And Jimmy Carter, you know, the Carter Institute has now come out and said this would be ill-advised. Jimmy Carter is my number one guy. Charlotte in Cuesta, New Mexico. Oh, I wanted to, Charlotte, let me put you on hold for a second. Marilyn is calling from France, and that's a long, long distance phone call. So, Marilyn, listening in France, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Thank you for waiting. So, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It doesn't cost me anything to call you. I live in France.
Oh, okay. You have free calling because that's the way it is in France, you mean, or because you've got, like,
it's
Skype
part
of
my
or something?
Package. I can call anywhere in the world with no extra charge. I pay 70 euros a month for DSL, cable TV, a BlackBerry, and this landline where I can call anywhere in the world.
Unlimited.
70 euros.
70 euros, about $100 a month.
Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. And what's the and your on your
company Orange.
And for your high speed internet, what's your download speed, do you know?
Well, they say that because I'm in a rural area, my download speed isn't as fast as the fastest DSL, but I'll tell you what, it's faster than the DSL I have in Seattle, Washington, where they say it's the fastest.
Right. So you don't know the number, though? Is it, you know, 50 or 100 meg?
No.
Or, yeah, okay.
No, I it's pretty
okay.
fast.
Huh. Yeah.
I have no complaint.
That's what I've heard, is that France has some of the best internet connections in the world because they enforce competition. You've got a whole bunch of different companies you can buy
yeah.
from, right? Yeah. Yeah. And
yeah.
Here we enforce monopoly.
I buy from the big company, the most expensive one, the old France Telecom, you
mm-hmm.
know, because I like to maintain that landline. And if I had another company and something went wrong with that wire, then I would have to hire workmen to come and work on it.
I see. Okay. Very interesting. So, Marilyn, that's
yeah.
not what you wanted to call about.
No. I'm calling because it's anything goes, and I've been wanting to tell you this story for a long time. It validates your theory about John McCain and Karl Rove urging President Saakashvili of Georgia to attack the Russians in South Ossetia and Abkhazia.
Right.
So that McCain could look like the big hero.
Yeah, and this was as McCain was running for president.
Right.
Yeah.
So I was in Georgia, in Tbilisi, in 2005. I went there to do costumes for their ballet company.
Mm-hmm.
And I was seated next to President Saakashvili at the dinner after the opening night. And he had nothing but the most glowing praise for George W. Bush, who had recently been to visit in Georgia.
Right.
And they had named the big street that goes from the airport to the city George W. Bush Parkway. And President Saakashvili just loved George Bush.
Hmm.
And he only wanted to talk about freedom and democracy.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a smart man. He was educated at Harvard. You know, he's not some...
Well, and, you know, McCain helped him get $1 billion. I mean, after that whole South Ossetia thing, you know, we gave him $1 billion. And
yeah.
I never saw any kind of accounting of where that money went, other than that it went to him and his administration. So...
No, I don't know. But the whole thing was harebrained, attacking Russia. Little bitty
right.
Georgia.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I understand their beef because those two areas had been
contested,
part of Georgia.
Yeah.
But the people in those areas consider themselves to be Ossetians and Abkhazians, neither
right.
Russian
right.
nor Georgian.
That's correct.
And Russia has been settling Russians in that area, so
yeah.
we can say, oh, well, it's Russian.
Right.
Know?
Yeah. No, so I understand they have a gripe, but did you know that Karl Rove was in that area when he was under subpoena to testify before Congress about lying before Congress, and he ignored the subpoena, and that's where he was. He was at Yalta meeting with Saakashvili.
Right. He met with Saakashvili in Yalta.
Yeah, yeah. That's amazing. Marilyn, thanks for the call, and thanks for watching or listening to us in France. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. And the two new books I have out, The Crash of 2016 and The Last Hours of Humanity. Welcome back. Occupying the Media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you and Peter in Hopkins, Minnesota. Hey, Peter. Thanks for listening to KTNF. What's up?
Afternoon, Tom. On voter suppression, there's a case that that came down 5 days before the voter case that's so significant, and nobody seems to reference it. It's a case called Arizona et al. Versus the Intertribal Council of Arizona. And what they decided in that case was that in all federal elections, a person could not be required to provide anything more than an assertion under oath that they were a citizen of the United States.
This is the United States Supreme Court?
Yes, Supreme Court. Written by Scalia, believe it or not. And he said under the National Voter Registration Act.
And this didn't narrowly just apply to Indian reservations?
It didn't. I checked it as to who the people were involved in it, and it doesn't appear to.
What was the year of this case?
It was 5 days before the, it was this year.
It was this year, 2013?
Yeah.
Oh, you were, Shano, you were there? You covered it? We covered it. So how can these, how, oh, just, it only applied to Arizona?
Well, it applies to any state that puts through something that requires more in just the federal part of the election. That means for president, senator,
right,
congressperson.
Right.
On the state level, it's a different thing. But nobody cites this thing.
Can you make your mic hot, Shane? You don't have a mic. Okay. All right. Yeah, Shane's got the details on this. He's also the Supreme Court reporter for the Talk Radio News Service, and he said that that this can, yeah, you can use that crummy mic there, I think.
I think you can hear me now.
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay.
Can you hear him now, Peter?
Yeah.
Okay.
That case had to do with the Arizona form, and what they did is they changed part of it to require people to bring papers to prove their ID, and they asked the federal government for approval to do this because they're required to under the national voter ID voter law. The federal government did not give them that approval, and they did it anyways. And it got all the way to the Supreme Court. And what they were arguing is saying, we're a state. We have the right to run our elections our way. And the federal government
So this was about the Voting Rights Act.
Well, not, no. It's a Voter Registration Act.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And the federal government tells the states what guidelines they have to follow.
Right.
And if you're going to use something other than the federal form, that you have to get approval for that. And Scalia wrote the decision, but at the same time said, here's how you do it. You submit the form, then you appeal it when you get denied, and appeal it, and appeal it. And when that appeal gets here, then we'll hear this case. But because you didn't follow the rules, we're going to rule in favor of the federal government right now under the Supremacy Clause.
So this, in other words, this decision is not binding and does not prevent Iowa from purging their voting rolls.
Has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Nothing to do. It's just how... It's just,
I don't know. It would depend on how you read it. I mean, if it applies to everybody voting in a federal election, then they actually have to go through they can't put in these requirements to start with.
But they're doing it, so that must be possible and legal.
Birth things in abortion cases.
They're doing it kind of in reverse. What they're saying is we're going to purge these people, but when they come back in, the level of proof that they have to give has to be approved by the federal system. So when they purge them, yes, you have to come back in and re-register and prove it. That level of proof is set by the forms that have been approved by the federal government. If they haven't, then you have the Arizona situation. I know
which
it's kind
only
of
requires this,
yeah. So this is a fairly narrow case.
Yeah, but that's right. In Arizona. If Arizona goes and gets approval eventually for something more than that, then yes. We don't know that Iowa is saying you have to bring in all these documents and birth certificates and all that. And if they do that, and that is contrary to the federal law, and they haven't gotten approval, then yes, we do have a similar case.
Okay. Very interesting.
It's happening that way in Texas and also in Carolina.
Yeah. Well, Peter, I'm going to dig into this a little more, and we'll see if there's anything more to this. But thank you for bringing that to our attention, Adam in Oak Brook, Illinois. Hey, Adam, you want to correct me on the history of Iran? I am certainly not a scholar of the history of Iran. What did I say that was wrong?
I mean, I hate to be critical, but I almost
feel free.
Some of what you said for Rush Limbaugh, because according to your history, after World War I, the United States split the Ottoman Empire into different Arab states, and then we overthrew the democratically elected leader of Iraq, Mohammed Mossadegh, and we installed him with...
Yeah, that was all wrong. In fact, I got that corrected in the next segment. It was Mossadegh was in Iran, not Iraq, and yeah.
Also, for the other two things, I'm glad that you did some research afterwards. We did not split the Ottoman Empire after World War I. That was the League of Nations.
I know. The we that I was talking about were the victors, after the Western powers after World War I.
And just also to clear this up, we never installed Saddam Hussein in 1968. He actually did not come to power until about 1976, and at which point he was a senior minister in a government that had already been established.
Right, and he came to power by military coup, did he not?
No, not by military coup. He was in a military coup, but in the 60s. But he was one of the second in commands at that point in time. He did not.
So how did he come to power in 76?
76, he was one of the deputy vice ministers of a man named al-Bakir. I'm probably butchering his name. Mm-hmm. But the current leader, al-Bakir, was weak and ailing, and Saddam realized that this is an opportunity to gain power. So he made crucial alliances with Ba'ath Party members, and he tried to expose a fifth column in the Ba'ath Party, got a bunch of people arrested, and at that point took power for himself. But he was never...
Interesting.
It's not like the United States installed him. He was never friendly to us at the beginning.
Okay. Adam, thank you for correcting the record. I appreciate it. It's great to have people smarter than me listening to the program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And on that note, by the way, it is Anything Goes Friday. Picking up more of your calls right after this. This is how wacky it gets. I mentioned this in the news yesterday, but it's worth revisiting. William T. Woodward, this guy down in Florida, his next-door neighbors, he felt that they were threatening him. And so on Labor Day, he snuck up, their next-door neighbors, right? He snuck up on the, came up to the hedge, whatever, and just shot them both dead. And now he's in jail. And he's asserting two defenses. The first is the Florida Stand Your Ground, Shoot First law. And the second is the Bush Doctrine. I'm not making this up. He's actually claiming in court that George W. Bush established legal precedent by saying we should attack Saddam Hussein before he attacks us because he represents a threat to us. The Bush Doctrine, preemptive attack. And that's why he killed his neighbors, because they represented a threat to him. All right. Okay. Jason in D.C. Jason, you wanted to talk about debt causing economic problems?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was thinking about your book here, and we're at about 132 days now that the U.S. debt is capped. Somehow, mysteriously, it has not gone a penny above the $16.699 billion.
Well, we've dialed back spending. The economy has recovered, so tax revenues have increased. The sequester has chopped a chunk out of us.
Started.
And the Treasury Department's moving money around in accounts.
How am I going to finish?
Sure.
Since the interest rates have gone up, the 10-year Treasury's gone from 1.6 to 2.9. The housing mortgage applications are now collapsing. The housing recovery is fictitious because all it was basically people just being able to buy more house with a lower interest payment. And now we're going to see this stuff start to play out, whereby we're unfortunately going to be in a position where we have double the amount of debt that we did from 5 or 6 years ago. And because of the rates being so low, the interest payment's been the same. But if these rates start moving back up, it's going to collapse the economy.
Yeah, I understand your logic. And I would say that as that logic applies to the private economy, which has, my recollection is $39 trillion in, there's either $39 or $49 trillion in private debt in the private economy in the United States, as interest rate, you know, corporate plus personal debt, that as interest rates go up, that debt gets much more expensive, and that will crash the economy. I don't think that the government having to spend a couple extra, you know, $100 billion in interest every year because the interest rates went up on a debt that's roughly equal to GDP is going to do anything, because the government has the ability to raise taxes. I mean, they can raise that money, but General Electric can't.
Over the last, you know, over these last 132 days or so since this debt limit and these interest rates have been backing up, the amount of money, remember, with the quantitative easing that we've done, lowered the rates, but now the rates are exactly back to where we were before we began the big quantitative easing 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And since that, all of the Treasury bills that the government has purchased, the Fed, they've collectively lost $220 billion.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's only going to get worse and steamroll.
No, I don't disagree with you that it's a disaster, and in fact, I mean that's at one of the core premises of my book, The Crash of 2016, is that crash of 2007-2008 never ended. That basically they took papier-mâché and you know, papered it over. And one of the major instruments was low interest rates, was, you know, just flooding the banks and the and thus the economy with money. And that the day of reckoning is going to come, that, you know, we have to have a real economy. We don't have a real economy anymore. A service economy is not a real economy. We don't make things. We don't create wealth anymore.
If I was to strip out the amount from the S&P 500, I take out all the banks that basically marked up their balance sheets because real estate getting better.
Yep.
Earnings are actually down.
Yeah.
So, you know, these
and they're going to crash.
People think, again, is housing earnings or recovery of real estate earnings, which, of course, people don't buy houses. They buy payments.
That's right.
And now what's going to happen is the $500,000 to $200,000 house you might have been able to buy before, you're going to be able to buy less house on the same payment. And the last time we got into this situation was back from 1966 to 1981. And that is an interesting time. We basically went off the gold standard where our money was backed by gold. We went on a fiat currency. And then after that point, that's when basically everybody's wife had to go get a job. Instead of, honey, I'd like you to get a job, it was, honey, you need to get a job.
Well, you can argue that. I would argue that did not correlate with our going off the gold standard, and that was Nixon in 71, but rather that correlated with the changes that happened in the early 80s in the Reagan administration. Well, there were a couple of things. I mean, you know, one of them was the birth control pill in 1960, right? And many more women came into the job market in the 60s and 70s. Because they could, because they had better control of their reproductive systems, and you know, that was going on. And so, yeah, people, let's have more house, let's have, you know, two people working. But when it really, really started picking up steam was when executive compensation rules changed, and that happened in 82 and 83. And that was, you know, prior to that time, if an executive was compensated more than $1 million, the corporation could not deduct that excess compensation. And you could not compensate an executive with stock options. And when Reagan changed that, rule, what it did was it allowed executives to start taking, instead of just 30 times what the average worker was taking in pay, executives could now take 100 times, 200 times, 300 times, 400 times.
I'm talking about the 70s. 66 to 81,
yeah.
About Reagan, okay, from 66 to 81 when the interest rates topped out at 18.45 on a 30-year fixed mortgage.
Right.
Okay, Reagan only had a couple of years in office, but what happened during this time frame when we went off the gold standard was that we debased the currency by 50%, and this is the only way out of this. You're either going to have to raise taxes by some gigantic level, or you're going to debase the currency so that everybody gets paid, but the payment is really going to cost the government 10 cents, 50 cents on the dollar.
Sure.
And we go back to that same thing on your book about these crashes. Guess what it was? The reparations after World War One that we put on Germany and the other countries, of course, there was no way they could pay the debts back. So what did they do? They hyperinflated their way out to pay the debts that we put on them.
I know.
It's the same cycle over again.
I've talked about that several times on the radio, and it's
debt
in my book.
Is dangerous.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't disagree. And we will debase our currency. We will continue to debase our currency in order to be able to pay back debt with cheaper money. There's no doubt about that in my mind either. And when we do that, you're going to see interest rates go up. And that's going to, but what I'm saying is that the disaster that the increased interest rates, first of all, what it's going to do is it's going to expose the fact that we basically haven't had a real economy since the 70s or 80s in the United States. As manufacturing moved outside the United States, we've gone from 35% of our GDP being based in manufacturing to around 15% or 11%, excuse me. And anytime a country goes below 15%, you know, you just can't sustain an economy with manufacturing below 15%. We're there.
Oh,
and we're pretending we're not.
You have a worldwide phenomenon here of transfer. Basically, only 20% of the jobs that we lost to manufacturing that went to China, the vast majority that we've lost over the last 13 years has actually been to automation. If you go through Ray Kurzweil's book, The Singularity, it
sure.
Just talks about the fact that it used to be 100 people in an auto plant, and you've got it down to 50 because you got robots painting them, robots assembling them, robots welding them together. You don't need as many people to make things.
No, you're right. Actually, it's not that you don't need as many people. You don't need as many person hours. And that's why back in 1968, Time magazine did the cover story about the coming leisure society, because as automation was increasing, the need for person hours was going down. And so what they projected was that the average work week, which had been at 60 hours in 1900, was down to 50 hours by the 1930s. It was, you know, the 1940s after World War II, or 40-hour work week, that the average work week would be down to 20 hours a week, but the wages would remain the same. And the reason that didn't happen, and in fact, that's where it would be right now. Right now, if productivity had tracked, if wages had tracked productivity from 1980 to today, the way that they did from 1900 to 1980, the average working person in America would be working about 30 hours a week and would be making a little over $90,000 a year. But the reason that we're not is because Reagan changed the rules for executive compensation, and this basically the CEO class figured out a way to steal all that money. All that, literally hundreds of billions of dollars. You've got six people, the six heirs of the Walton fortune. Everybody says, oh, Walmart, you know, they got to pay their employees crap wages so that they can, you know, have a functioning business model. Well, that's nonsense. You got the six heirs of the Walton fortune are worth more than a third of America. They have more wealth than a third of America. The McDonald's fortune, the, you know, it goes on and on and on. What has happened is we've seen this enormous transfer of wealth, not to the 1%, but to the 1/1000th of 1%. They're making off like bandits with the money that should be with working people, and it's because of the changes that Reagan did in the 80s in the way that you can compensate executives and deduct it. And then to add insult to injury, not only are we compensating executives with stock options so that, you know, corporations can deduct it and get around the $1 million rule, which was raised to $2 million a while back, but then when the executives exercise those options, they get to call it long-term capital gains and pay a maximum income tax of 20%. Whereas you and I, if you work for a paycheck, have to pay a maximum of 39%. So, but, you know, Jason, I think on some of these things we agree. I'm not convinced that the gold standard is the solution to all things, but certainly our country has historically, every country does, debased its currency. That's why we shoot for 2 or 3% inflation every year, so that we can always pay off our debt with cheaper money. Jason, thanks for the call. We'll talk again. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And when that crash happens, I would not have my money in one of the big banks. Good time for credit unions. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all of the people at our various syndicators, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, CRN Network, to Free Speech TV Network, Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our program, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones, and all the great folks at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, and to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. We wouldn't be here without you. It's really, really true. Doug in St. Peter's, Missouri. Hey, Doug, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great.
I was considering that. I had some time to. Yeah, I know. I tell people now it depends on who you ask. About Texas, and I figured that, well, they won't get any post office delivery. They'll have to make their own delivery system.
Ah, that's right. If Texas secedes,
they got to
figure out their own postal stuff.
Right. There's going to be no air traffic controllers.
Or they have to do their own.
I mean, they won't have the money. They won't have the money for that. It's just like colleges are not going to have any college students either because the U.S. government's not going to give them.
The colleges will all be privately run by billionaires, and they'll only teach the things the billionaires want people to know, right? Like the billionaires are good things, right?
Right. It'll be how to dig ditches 101 and flip hamburgers and
right.
Bring me a bottle of wine.
Right. Be a good surf. Yep.
And I also figure that all of the roads outside of, like, the major metropolitan area and where the really 1% live, they won't be able to maintain them, so they'll have gravel road system.
Right. They're doing that right now, actually. Texas is tearing up.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Roads become dirt.
And they'll need passports to leave Texas.
Yep. Of course. And you're going to have a passport to get in, too. I'm wondering if they would be more afraid of people coming in or if they would actually try to prevent people from leaving. I mean, you know, if it turns into a slave state.
So they would have to try to keep people in.
Right,
so they'd have to do a Berlin Wall.
That's right. And they would have to have the equivalent of the Runaway Slave Act.
And they wouldn't get any federal government money, which means that, like you were saying earlier, they get more money than they put into the system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to depress them even more, and people are going to be fleeing. And can you imagine all the people who don't want to live in a theocracy going?
Yeah, I
think they should do it.
Yeah, I think it would be a fascinating experiment, a fascinating one. Doug, thanks for the call. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, I just posted on your Facebook page and on the member blog here that I put up a petition about Syria.
Mm-hmm. At change.org?
It's a change.org petition.
Okay.
And basically, we have the right to talk about being our conscience acting that way after we reform. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're the ones who use phosphor weapons, cluster bombs, landmines, depleted uranium, nuclear weapons. And basically, I'd say, let he who is without sin cast the first drone.
Cast the first drone. That's brilliant. Okay. Jeff, well said.
We have a lot to get our own house in order, and we don't know who the players are. Blowback is one of the biggest problems we've had.
Yeah, blowback is a tough one. Jeff, well said. Thank you very much for the call. David in Chicago. Hey, David.
Hi. I heard a caller earlier talk about a period of time between 1966 and 1982, and that happened to be a very long secular bear market. The secular bull market started from 82 to 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, during that 66 to 82 period, William McKesney Martin was head of the Federal Reserve, and his philosophy was, quote unquote, to take away the punch bowl just as the party gets going, which that is to say, raise interest rates just when the economy reaches peak activity after a recession.
Right.
Contrast this to Alan Greenspan that actually fed the bubble as Federal Reserve.
Right. Alan Greenspan's theory was pour more vodka into the punch.
Yeah. So we had much better stewardship under Martin, even though 66 to 82 was a secular bear market. In fact, it was a period of prosperity.
It was.
Large, although in the late 70s, you had kind of...
There were no bubbles. But also during that period of time, you had a top income tax rate of 91 down to 74%. And you had very, very tight restrictions on how executives could be compensated.
As you had the capital markets in line with the real productive everyday economy.
That's right.
Right now, we have a decoupling between the capital markets and the people that manage capital and the real everyday economy that most of us live in, like the 99.8% of us.
Yes.
And this is a crime. It's like Jonathan Swift's, you know, Gulliver's Travels land. Surreal almost.
Yeah, you're right. When 70% of your activity in the stock market is you know, a couple of dozen machines in that are doing micro trades, you know, or microsecond trades in New York City, you've got the whole financialization of everything. It's insane. David, excellent. Thank you. Robert in Mesa, Arizona. Last minute, Robert. What's up?
Yes, I was just calling to say that I watch C-SPAN a lot, so I saw the testimony of Clapper and Alexander. And the notes that are coming out of Snowden's dump has proven to many that they were lying, but I found some information through the Federation of American Scientists at FAS.org that shows there was a program called Project 415 in 1988 that specified how the data and what kind of data was desired to be collected. It was basically everything from every source, wired, wireless, satellite.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's what they've done. Robert, thank you for sharing that. And I shouldn't say it so glibly. I think we really need to be having a discussion, a debate about this, about what the NSA is up to. Anyhow, tomorrow, the latest news on Syria, Monday, and information from the weekend, plus Congress will be back next week, so this should be entertaining. And don't forget, democracy isn't a spectator sport. It has to be. You have to participate. So get out there, occupy something, get active, find your niche and or your passion. Tag your it. See you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman.
For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.